We now come to our last presentation for this panel. Nicholas Capaldi, professor of philosophy at the University of Tulsa. Professor Capaldi has written on a wide variety of topics. He's an expert on David Hume. He's written books on affirmative action. I understand he's presently working on a book on John Stuart Mill. I don't know quite what to make of the fact that the panel has two economists and one philosopher on it in talking about the renewal of the market order. There are several competing hypotheses here. One might be that economics is twice as important as philosophy in terms of it, but another hypothesis might be it only takes one philosopher to make as powerful an argument as two economists. So, Nick, it's all yours.
One thing that PJ forgot to mention is the title of my paper, which is Please Keep Awake Even Though It's Late in the Afternoon. One of the things that we have forgotten is that the business of America is business. We do not require a renewal of the market order, but rather a renewal of our understanding of the market order. And in order to jog your memory on this particular point, I beg your indulgence while I quote one very acute observer of American society, namely Alexis de Tocqueville. And I quote, "To transform the vast uninhabited continent, which is his domain, the American requires the daily support of an energetic passion. That passion can only be the love of wealth. The passion for wealth is therefore not reprobated in America. And provided it does not go beyond the bounds assigned to it for public security, it is held in honor. The American lauds as a noble and praiseworthy ambition what our forefathers in the Middle Ages stigmatized as servile cupidity. In the United States, fortunes are lost and gained without difficulty. The country is boundless and its resources inexhaustible. They are always surrounded by more than they can appropriate. It is not the ruin of a few individuals, which may be soon repaired, but the inactivity and sloth of the community at large, which would be fatal to such a people. Boldness of enterprise is the foremost cause of its rapid progress, its strength and its greatness. Commercial business is there like a vast lottery, by which a small number of men continually lose, but the state is always a gainer. Such a people ought therefore to encourage and do honor to boldness in commercial speculations. The Americans who make a virtue of commercial temerity have no right in any case to brand with disgrace those who practice it." End of quote. That's about 170 years old. I would defend every sentence in it. In its present context, the market economy is the greatest force in the modern world. It has transformed and continues to transform the moral landscape by improving the material conditions of life and by institutionalizing individual freedom. One would think, therefore, that such a phenomenon deserves special attention and praise. Curiously, it is the most misrepresented of all institutions. Part of the reason for this misrepresentation is that it has been largely described by both its enemies and its misguided friends. I would argue that in the modern world, hostility to commerce is the anti-Semitism of the learned world. There are three specific respects in which I think the problem has become more acute. Prior to 1989, a number of people who had reservations about the market order muted those reservations, but they have not done so since. Secondly, a number of very subtle objections have been developed. And thirdly, as the university has grown and thrived, especially universities that were established by private benefactors, the hostility to the market has only increased. Now, my imagination cannot anticipate every single misrepresentation and misinformed view about the market order. So rather than dwell on that, I'm simply going to extend the challenge to the audience.
Right.
If any of you thinks that the market order is responsible for some evil or other, I suggest that you bring it up during the discussion period, and I promise to refute it on the spot.
Right.
Now let me begin by setting the record straight. I'm going to, Richard only mentioned, I think, four things. I'm going to mention six, some of which will overlap. First, the market economy has improved the living standard of everyone in the world. Now, why is this the case? Let me put it into a larger historical context for you. The great force in the modern world since at least the 16th century has been what I call the technological project, as originally articulated by people like Bacon and Descartes. It is the notion that we are here to make ourselves the masters and possessors of the world. No doubt this project is fraught with all kinds of difficulties and obstacles, but it is in fact a magnificent project, and there's no going back. What the technological project requires, it was soon discovered, was a market economy. And the person who made clear what the connection between the two happened to be was Adam Smith, who stated that if you have a market economy, you will soon have a division of labor, and a division of labor will lead to innovation. And innovation is precisely what the technological project needs. And the one lesson that has to be relearned, apparently historically every two generations, is that you cannot compete technologically unless you have a market economy. Second point I would make about the improvement in living standards of the world is that wealth liberates us from the culture of poverty. That whereas in the medieval world, it was wealth that created a scandal, the scandal of the modern world is the existence of poverty. Another point to be made in connection with this is the importance of disaster relief. No matter where in the world a disaster takes place, and it is necessary somehow to cope with it, people immediately start making telephone calls, and those telephone calls always begin with the country code number one. The greatest form of flattery is imitation. And here I think Fukuyama's thesis is correct. Whether they want to or not, everybody in the world is trying as fast as they can to catch up and make themselves like America. In fact, some of these ways in which they do this have become extremely creative. I'm thinking, for example, of the EU, where they're attempting to duplicate America on the basis of anti-Americanism, something that I think only a French intellectual could possibly understand. Yes. Market order has also institutionalized individual political freedom. There are no democracies without a market economy. It is a necessary but not sufficient condition. A market economy requires two things. First, by definition, private property, and secondly, limited government, by which I mean things like the rule of law and something akin to individual rights. The purpose of government is to make sure that the conditions are right for people to pursue their economic dreams. So in this respect, the development of a market economy leads by logic, I would argue, to at least the notion of limited government. There's another distinction that I think captures what I'm after here, and it was made by Michael Oakeshott. It's the distinction between a civil association and an enterprise association. An enterprise association, as I'm sure most of you will recall, has a collective good. What is peculiar about a civil association is that what it lays down are the rules by which we play the game. But the object of the game is not some particular end. The object of the game is to allow each of us to pursue whatever our vision happens to be. And it is in that sense that a market economy is absolutely essential if you're going to have a civil association as opposed to a collective good of the entire society. Wealth provides the dynamic of social reform. And I would conclude this particular point by saying that it is precisely because it institutionalizes individual economic freedom and political freedom that Islamic extremists hate us. And this is a respect in which I would maintain that a culture should be judged by its enemies, not just by its friends. And I'm rather proud to have Islamic extremists as my enemy. Third, market order has replaced religious fanaticism with religious freedom and toleration. It does this by insisting that the political structure has to be secular. Some people, I suspect there may even be hidden in this audience, people who think that a society is moral only if that particular person's moral priorities are somehow institutionalized and forced upon everybody else. We went through that in the 17th century, and we learned rather quickly that that notion of moralizing a society leads to tremendous brutality and to brutalization. As Richard has already pointed out, religion continues to flourish in our society precisely because while religion may be an enterprise association, the larger civil association in which we operate permits any number of enterprise associations to operate within it. And I think that becomes the explanation for the point that he's already made, that in countries where there's an official state religion, the houses of worship are nearly empty, whereas in America there is a great deal of religious activity precisely because it is not state-sponsored. Fourth general claim I would make on behalf of a market order is that it has liberated women and transformed family life. First, with regard to women, since we are no longer tied to a feudal and agricultural economy, it is no longer necessary for women to be restricted to one or two functions. It is now possible for people to choose a career, to choose their spouse, and to choose where they want to live. We tend to take this for granted without realizing that this is peculiar to a market order. One way in which this was brought home to me, some years ago, I taught at the National University of Singapore. And just after I had arrived, a delegation of female students invited me to participate on a panel. And since I was newly arrived and anxious to ingratiate myself, I accepted the invitation before even asking them what the subject of the panel was to be. I began to wonder if there was something in my demeanor by which I was somehow sending out the wrong signal about myself. I was a bit uneasy, but I went to the panel anyway because I said I would show up. When I did, it turned out that the sexual revolution in Singapore meant that women should be allowed to approve of the person to whom they were going to be married. And I felt comfortable with that because that was the level at which I could handle it. But there's a larger issue here that I think historically is often missed. If you think of the way the relationship between men and women begins to be pictured, let us say in the novels of Jane Austen, or even in the philosophy of Hegel and later John Stuart Mill, you begin to get the notion of romantic love. Now, I do not mean that in any sort of trite sense in which you turn on soap operas in the middle of the day. What is meant by romantic love here is the notion that human fulfillment comes about when you are associated with somebody who is personally autonomous, and therefore, in that important respect, you're equal. That would not have been possible without a market order. And I don't think it's an accident that this development begins to take place in the late 18th and early 19th century. Later it will take other forms. If you follow the philosophy of John Stuart Mill, you begin to see arguments for why women should be allowed to own property. And it is precisely after they had the right to own property that they were given the right to vote. To pursue careers. And as Mill further points out, this revolution also liberated men. Now, in what respect did it liberate men? It liberated men because men were no longer taught to be or allowed to be, at least on a large scale, petty tyrants. And if the home and the family becomes a context in which males are allowed to become petty tyrants, this will obviously affect the society as a whole. But most of all, it had a transforming effect on children. Up until market economy is in full swing, let's say by the middle of the 18th or early 19th century, If people had children, children were the inadvertent byproducts of a biological process, or they were seen as objects of utility. That's no longer the case. As a result of the market order, we now think of children as subjects of cultivation. We bring them into the world in order to create another autonomous being. One of the consequences of that, of course, is that they will not support you in your old age. So I think that's something you should keep in mind. It has also improved the quality of family life. The family is not a means to another end. It actually becomes the end of a good society. Getting married, setting up house, raising children, struggling to bring oneself and one's family to the greatest degree of accomplishment is what a free society is all about. The family is a private social security system. The family provides support for mobility, a common pattern being that the first established member creates a base to which other family members can come later and thus ease the burden of transition, a common pattern amongst immigrants. In poorer families, the pattern is one of concentrating savings by giving a special advantage, most especially education, to one member. And surely the most common pattern is seen in the sacrifices that parents make for the education of their children. Finally, one of the greatest innovations that energetic and creative young people bring to the marketplace is not only the desire to found a fortune, but the desire to have a durable and substantial legacy to pass on to their children. 5, market order promotes world peace. Why? Because the creation of wealth, unlike going to war, is not a zero-sum game. As Hume, Constant, and Kant make obvious, there's an international division of labor, and it is the market order that brings the world closer together. Rather than competing in a destructive way, we actually see ourselves as helping each other. And the challenge to be made in connection with this, it's an old argument, but I think it's worth making. If you try to think of all of the major conflicts that have taken place in the world in the last 200 years, roughly since the time Kant wrote Perpetual Peace, can you think of a single example of a major conflict where all the combatants on both sides were large commercial republics, or even small commercial republics? I think you would have difficulty coming up with a single example. And if you do, I'll simply declare by definition that it doesn't count. Okay. 6, and this is the most important point. I think that a market order promotes spiritual values. I think that modernity is a spiritual quest, and I think that what it's a spiritual quest for is personal autonomy. Explaining what that means in detail would take me a great deal of time. I'm more than happy to do it, even with the obtuse, but I think that most of you understand what I mean by that. Examples of this are, number one, philanthropy. Again, it is the American society with its emphasis on the market order that is the most philanthropic country in the world. I'm always amazed when I go abroad to give lectures at foreign institutions, universities, and discover that most students abroad have not the foggiest notion that the most prestigious institutions of higher education in the United States were all established by people they would consider robber barons. It maximizes the opportunity to pursue a whole spectrum of values. It enhances the human condition. Income is not merely a means to consumer satisfaction, and it's not merely an incentive. Rather, income is a means to accomplishment. Participation in a market economy, informed by personal autonomy, actually promotes a variety of forms of virtuous behavior. This is a point that is lost on those, especially intellectuals, whose hostility to the market leads to a pervasive ignorance and misrepresentation of the operations of the market economy. I'll conclude with one example. Some years ago, I was a junior scholar at the Hoover Institution. I'm not going to mention how many years ago. And while I was there, I had the privilege of meeting and mingling with many of the people whom I considered my intellectual heroes. One such individual was the recent winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics. And during the course of my stay, this distinguished economist gave a lecture. And consistent with his personality and reputation, at the end of the lecture, when the question period started, he called on the younger scholars first. And when came my turn to ask a question, I asked the following question. I said, what would happen if you found a society that had a planned economy such that the planned economy turned out to be more productive and more efficient than one in a free society? He said, that's not possible. I said, I agree, you don't have to present an argument for that. But just treat it hypothetically. Suppose it happened. What would your position be then? And he thought a moment and he replied, I would still want to have a free economy. And I said, why? And his answer was, because of the freedom. The efficiency is icing on the cake, but what it's all about is freedom. And you will not be surprised to know that the person who made that statement was one of the co-founders of the Philadelphia Society, Milton Friedman. Thank you.